We don't have a quorum yet. I think we're one short. But we'll start the meeting, and when we have a quorum, we'll...
We need 11.
Oh, sorry.
So we'll start with the testimony, and today we're going to hear from Lauren Coleman, the Assistant Commissioner of Human Services, to talk about continuing care. And just before you start, maybe you could tell us, after you introduce yourself. And by the way, we now have a quorum, so Representative Tao has carefully read the minutes, and do you wish to move?
Yes, approval? I did, Mr. Chair, and I so move.
Any discussion of the minutes? Hearing and seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. So we are now in order, and we're going to hear from Commissioner Coleman. I was going to say, just before you start, the overall budget that you're talking about, dollars of state money and dollars of federal money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Coleman, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services for Continuing Care. We manage very large programs, and if you consider state funds, we manage about $3.5 billion per biennium, and if you consider all funds, we're looking at about $6.5 billion. So they are very large programs that serve a lot of people. I'll begin the presentation on page 156. And please note that some of the pages within the continuing care section of the book that reference adult mental health and chemical health grants will be presented by Assistant Commissioner Kleistra at a later date, since that's under his administration. I'll point out those pages as we proceed through the book. Our continuing care programs touch over 350,000 people in Minnesota annually. They range in services from 24-hour institutional care and long-term care facilities for about 36,000 people per month, or 83,000 people who receive congregate or home-delivered meals, and 19,000 deaf and hard of hearing consumers, to an excess of 90,000 people that receive some sort of one-to-one counseling by calling the linkage lines. And again, we'll get into more detail, but I wanted to give you a sense of scope here. We partner with counties, health plans, public agencies, and private for-profit and not-for-profit agencies to deliver the services. Our overarching goal is to help older Minnesotans and people with disabilities so that they can be independent and retain or improve their quality of life and be participants and contributors in their communities. Again, I'll reference the size of the programs, $3.5 billion in state funds, $6.5 billion in all funds. I'll begin with aging and adult services on page 159. Aging and adult services pays for the non-medical and social service programs for communities to develop informal services to keep older people engaged in their communities. Again, you will hear at a later date about the health care programs that are managed by Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg. So this is the non-medical part of people's lives. To be eligible for aging and adult services, most of the programs require you to be age 60 or older. We target programs mostly to those individuals who have the greatest social and economic needs. Most of the programs need to be in conformance with the Older Americans Act, which is a federal program. Some examples of services that we manage. Nutritional services, including meals, grocery delivery, nutrition education counseling, transportation services, chore services, Assistance with daily activities for frail older adults in the community. Information and assistance that I've referenced through the senior linkage line and the MinnesotaHelp.info and other long-term care planning tools. We do a fair amount of counseling through those vehicles about Medicare, supplemental insurance, long-term care options, the infamous Medicare Part D enrollment and processes that continue as an ongoing need. We provide respite and other supportive services to family caregivers, including options for consumer-directed supports for older Minnesotans. And then we have worked quite extensively on the expansion and development of more home and community-based services and housing options throughout Minnesota. For background, the Older Americans Act was passed by Congress in 1965. Again, the purpose was to assist older people to remain in the community and live as independently as possible. We administer in Minnesota those funds through the Minnesota Board on Aging, and they are an integral part of the Department of Human Services, and we work hand in hand. I will note, though, that federal funding for many of the programs that are coming through the Older Americans Act and the federal government have remained static since 2002. We try to track how well we're doing in managing these programs and serving older Minnesotans. And on page 160, you see a couple of the measurements that we use. One is the proportion of publicly funded long-term care funds that are spent in institutional settings versus community settings. And as you can see, we have had a steady, gradual shift to more home and community-based services and less reliance on the institutional model. Another measurement that we track is how many people are being served in the various programs via institutional-based services or community-based services. And again, you can see that there's a steady trend there, and we now serve more people in the community than we do in the institutional settings. And again, more detail on that a bit later when we get into the specific programs. So that's kind of the overview of aging and adult services. When we get into some of the specific grants, you may have some questions more in more detail about the various grants. With permission, I'll proceed to page 162 and talk about the alternative care program. The Alternative Care Program is a state-funded program that pays for at-home and community-based services for older adults who are at risk of becoming eligible for medical assistance, nursing facility care, and the current criteria is within 4.5 months, 135 days. In fiscal year 2005, we served almost 5,000 people, an average cost of just a little bit over $1,000 per month. Again, some examples of what alternative care will fund. Respite care, again, maintaining a family member in one's own home is a challenge, and a break for caregivers and for those that are supporting elderly people in the community is a necessary feature. Case management, working directly with the individual to make sure that he or she is receiving the right amount of services at the right time. Alternative care can also fund adult day care, personal care services, homemaker services, and training and education for caregivers. There's a lot that caregivers want to know, need to know, and part of the alternative care program will fund that kind of very specific training so that individuals know how to deal most effectively with their frail family member. Chore services, home health services, transportation, nutrition, telehome care is a emerging feature of all of our programs so that we can make best use of our resources. Alternative care, in our judgment, is a cost-effective program, and we believe that it is helping people be maintained in the community as long as possible. Again, some of the... I'm sorry.
This is all state money, no federal money.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This is state-funded only. Again, it contributes to the measurements of trying to look at where we are spending our dollars, whether it be in institution or community-based settings, and the number of people that we're serving.
Representative Awer.
Mr. Chair, and is this a forecasted program or an appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, this is a state-appropriated program,
Mr. Chair.
It's not forecasted.
Mr. Chair, is there a demand for more than this, or is there a waiting list of some kind, or is it just managed within our budget?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, this program has had a number of modifications to it during the last several years, and so what we've seen is kind of a dip because we've changed eligibility, we've changed the setting that people are eligible for the program, and it's showing a gradual kind of return to people using it. At this point in time, there is sufficient funds to meet the demand.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can give me just a brief summary of what the telehome services, what does that encompass?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood. Telehome is emerging in many different ways. They can monitor post-acute stays in a variety of ways now so that people can have blood pressure and other diagnostic tools without having to go to a clinic so that they can intervene earlier and prevent rehospitalization, and it can be monitored from the clinic office. That's an example of how telehome care is kind of emerging as a positive tool.
Medical assistance would not pay for that, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, most of that kind of clinical post-acute care would be eligible for Medicare reimbursement, but it is part of a medical assistance benefit now under certain circumstances.
Was there another person over here? Representative Leffler.
Mr. Chairman and Assistant Fisher, I know that the use of assisted living services within this program has been growing, where people actually do move out of their traditional family home. And can you tell us a little bit about, you know, sort of what you see as the trends in that and how many people are served in the kind of their long-term family home versus moving to a different housing setting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, assisted living in this program is no longer eligible for funding. That was a change that was made recently, a couple years ago, by the legislature that focused this program on keeping individuals in their home. A little bit later on, I will be talking more extensively about assisted living and the growing use of that option for consumers. So we'll talk more specifically about that growth. And we have a proposal to... for consideration by the legislature about assisted living.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
We will continue on page 165. We have a budget activity, long-term care facilities grants. Nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded and day services are an important component of our healthcare delivery system. All individuals who enroll for medical assistance, this is a medical assistance page now, must apply and be deemed eligible for long-term care services. Some descriptors. We have approximately 400 nursing facilities in the state of Minnesota with about 37,000 beds. Additionally, we have about 224 ICFMRs, or intermediate care facilities, for the mentally retarded, and they serve just under 2,000 individuals. And then additionally, we have 275 licensed day treatment and habilitation services that serve about 13,000 people with developmental disabilities throughout Minnesota. The use of nursing facilities and ICFMRs grew very rapidly in the 60s and 70s, and it was a national phenomenon. Minnesota was no different, and in fact probably used the institutional model more than many other states. And so you've heard history about how Minnesota was more reliant upon the institutional model, had more beds per thousand older people than most other states. We have had a trend in Minnesota, though, that moves us more to home and community-based services and alternative services, and less reliant or more targeted services within the institutional model. One feature of the nursing facility model that I would like to address is the quality measurements that have been developed. We historically began with a very regulatory approach to how to assure quality within the institutional model. We've now moved more towards publicly disclosing quality measures and using those as a factor in determining payment rates. We've worked very long and hard with stakeholders in the nursing facility industry to develop quality measures. What matters and what is important for consumers to know. It's not a perfect set of quality measures, and they continue to be modified, improved over time, but we were able to agree on an initial set of quality measures that would be reported in the nursing home report card, and those are listed on page 166. But again, I'll caution that these are not measures that will be valid forever as we move to more outcome-based measures rather than some of the, I guess, inputs that you would see on page 166.
Now, Commissioner Coleman, the Department of Health inspects for quality, and is that's in addition to what this is, and who are there inspections, or is this self-reporting other than the Department of Health?
Mr. Chair, it's a combination of both. The quality measures are comprised of both health department or external surveys, and there's a measurement for that. There's some self-reporting data that is then subject to audit. Either desk audit or field audit, where we go to the facilities and validate the information. And then an additional component is on-site resident interviews, where we have a questionnaire that is administered to a sample of the residents, and that's administered by a third party and tabulated. So it's a combination of all of the above.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Coleman, are you able to provide us with a list of the ICFMR located in the 62 counties? Is that available?
Mr. Chair, yes, that would be available. I wouldn't have that with me, but we can get that.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Continue.
We have a legislative proposal on page 170. This is our long-term care payment adjustment proposal. The governor recommends that medical assistance payment rates for all continuing care providers be increased by 2% effective October 1, 2007 and 7-1-2008 for some providers. The governor also recommends continuing the current law policy of attributing a portion of the nursing facility payment rates to performance measures. This proposal would increase payment rates for continuing care providers and certain grants for people that, who are elderly or have disabilities on that 10-1-07 and then again on 7-1. On the nursing facility component, we would increase it by 1.5% on October 1-07 and again on October 1-08, but also provide an opportunity for nursing facilities to have a quality add-on that would range from an additional, I got to do my math here, 0 to 1.2% additional. So the range for nursing facilities on 10-1-07 and then again on 10-1-08 would be from 1.5% total to a maximum of 2.7% total. All nursing facilities are eligible, and all, if they achieve the highest score, would be eligible for the maximum. We have some history with this. We implemented the quality add-on October 1, 2006, and out of 394 facilities in the state of Minnesota that was eligible for this rate adjustment, 373 received some of the quality add-on. Now, some was very small, some was towards the maximum. We continue to work with the Department of Health and the stakeholders to improve the quality measures and recognize that it's a program that needs to continue to evolve. The overall rate adjustment for continuing care providers recognizes that there are cost pressures in conducting business. And this is trying to recognize that cost pressure of serving older Minnesotans and people with disabilities. Questions about the rate change, please.
Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Coleman, so nursing facility rates would increase 1.5 and then another 1.5. And then we're in the governor's plan offering increases of, is it 2 and 2? So then when you balance that out, could you just discuss that briefly about the effect that has on our nursing homes?
Sure. Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative. Let me try to be more clear. On average, all facilities will receive a 2% increase. For the nursing facilities, the range will be from 1.5% to a maximum of 2.7%. And it would average 2%, similar to the other continuing care providers. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. The quality measures on which you'd be evaluated, are those the ones on page 166?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the quality measures that are used for the quality add-on are a subset of the report card. They're not identical. And they will be modified for 2007 quality add-on versus 2006. I won't characterize that there is universal agreement on what those quality measures are, but we have published what those quality measures that will be used for the quality add-on so that providers know what they will be measured on. For example, the consumer satisfaction quality of life scores, because it was a new program and we didn't have experience, was not used in the quality add-on for 2006. That was kind of an agreement with the stakeholders that we would implement the questionnaire with consumers and use that as a measurement for the payment portion at a later date. So we have published that we intend to use that measurement for 2007 quality add-on distribution. There was a perceived duplication between staff turnover and staff retention. So we've streamlined that to only use one of those, and now that I'm up in front of you, I'm confused as to which one we retained. We retained retention.
Good.
And we're no longer going to use turnover as a quality add-on measurement. We don't, for the quality add-on, use the single bed component. Although it's an important aspect for consumers to know about, it's not something that facilities have total control over. So that's not used as the quality add-on measurement. So hopefully that helps.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have really two questions. One is probably a little one, and I'm going to just ask them both, and then you can answer them if that's okay. First of all, I want to know why in the first year it's effective, proposed to be effective in October, in the second year in July. Okay. And then I just would like to hear a little bit more about the theory behind doing this QComp kind of reimbursement scheme. You know, what reason is there to believe that that this will be effective in improving quality?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the dates are a function of the amount of resources available for this page. It really isn't any more complicated than that. We had to use the money that was available for rate increases, and so we propose treating the rate increases for all providers of continuing care October 1, 2007, to make the budget page balance. There's no greater science behind it than that. On the quality add-on component, we have worked with the stakeholders, the nursing facility stakeholder groups, which includes the nursing facilities, the advocates, the workers, etc., in trying to agree on a new payment system. We've worked long and hard for many years to come up with a more balanced and effective payment system. The current system that we use, if you want to call it a system, is 12, 13 years old now. We have not been successful in getting concurrence on what a new system needs to look like, balancing the provider needs, the monies available, the workers' needs, etc. In spite of not agreeing on how to come forward to the legislature with one proposal that everyone can support, we still have a common interest in improving services to people who are living in nursing facilities. And payment does get attention. And so we have worked with the stakeholders to try and develop, my terminology, goals. What are areas that collectively we believe are important? And that's the report card, so people can have good and complete information. It's the customer satisfaction, so we can get feedback directly from the user of the service. And we have found that facilities, staff, all participants in this trying to meet the needs of older people and people with disabilities living in nursing facilities have really become quite engaged and focused on improving their scores so that they not only can maximize their rate increase, but also maximize the quality measurement and the report card that is public information. So we believe that a combination of efforts to improve care for people living in facilities, including incentives for payment, is appropriate. We have an additional program that I guess I'll digress and I'll mention it here, where we have a pay-for-performance program for nursing facilities. And it's a program that is being implemented as we speak, and it solicited proposals directly from facilities to tell us how they believe they can best improve service to people in their facilities. And we will pay them a bonus if they are selected and they achieve the outcomes that we have negotiated with that contract. So it's a multi-pronged approach to try to improve care for the people who live in nursing facilities in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. I'll try to not ask many questions. But Commissioner Coleman, the quality rating system is new. So will we be able to see the overall effect of it as immediately as you're suggesting? Or is this something like the school report card? Takes a while for the consumer to get used to and starts really weighing in on what information is available to us who either have loved ones in a nursing facility or are looking to place someone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, since this is the second time that we are proposing a quality add-on, our hope is that we'll see some evidence that, in fact, people have focused on these measures and will have improved the scores that are achieved throughout the facilities. We don't know that yet because we haven't collected all of the data from this rate year that this would apply to.
Representative Bunn.
Yes, Chair. Thank you, Chair, and Commissioner Coleman. I have a question regarding this entire sector. What proportion of the cost in this sector is taken up by wages and benefits? Just rough ballpark.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative, what is reported from the provider sector is that about 70% of the costs that of doing business are wage and benefit staffing related. In the past, the legislature has chosen to ask some of the continuing care providers to present compensation distribution plans that need to demonstrate that they in fact have distributed a portion or some percentage of the rate increase to staff members. Other providers of continuing care don't have that requirement.
Representative Bunn.
Chair, to follow up, I asked the question just because I'm interested in to the extent to which a 2% increase over a year or 1.5, the case may turn out to be for the nursing facilities keeps up with the cost pressures in the sector. We know that, like with school districts, that sometimes even now are planning for 16% increases contractually in their medical coverage portion of their workers, that if this is also 70% of it's for wages and benefits, it strikes me that 2% a year, 1.5% a year, after several years of flat and in real terms declining money to this sector, is probably not allowing them to remain competitive in the general labor market in terms of wages and benefit packages for their workers with these type of increases. I welcome your comments on that issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the pressures, the business pressures on providers of these services vary. There's no attempt to match this page with an exact match of what all businesses in this particular activity are experiencing. Some are able to experience efficiencies elsewhere. Some are more diversified in their payment streams. They have other payers. Others are more dependent upon medical assistance. So I acknowledge that. The provider community will come forward with a different number that they believe better represents their cost pressures, and that may or may not be more accurate. A piece of information, there is for the nursing facilities in current law a rate increase for alternative payment system facilities, which is now all nursing facilities that are in that program. That has been suspended into this next biennium, but the 2% rate increase that is proposed here is almost identical to what is in current law for that forecast in price increases.
Thank you.
Commissioner, sometimes you could just give us the history of the retention rate of employees. My understanding is very poor in the late 90s because they have such a high economy on the outside. And has that changed since then?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any direct data, but we can certainly try and see if we can find some data for you to consider.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And actually, kind of a rehash of the Representative Dunn question, but I've sat in one of these chairs here for now 9 years, which is a frightening thought. And we've had the same discussion and the same kind of questions. And some ask it a different way, and I recognize you're just the messenger. So in the past, I've been able to more blame the messenger, but now I realize you're just the messenger. So more fun doing it the other way, Mr. Coleman. But anyway, so given that there's hardly a business I know that can live on a point and a half, and most of these people don't have health insurance. At the department, I know you attempt to come forward with a budget that balances out all the needs, and on a budget that's finite, and it's like the robins and the, too many robins in the nest for the worms you got to pass out. But can you tell me the philosophical comfort that your department comes forward with, saying that a point and a half or 2% is going to be sufficient to provide the level of service that we want, knowing that in the past it's been very lean and even in some cases reductions? And I'm not being unkind, I'm just curious about what you expect these places to deliver, mm-hmm. even if the scrutinies are higher. So, and I guess I'll leave it at that. If you can answer that, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that's a tough question. There isn't a single number or a single aspect to this question that would satisfy all the parties. I don't think that we are suggesting that 2% will cover all of the cost pressures that are challenging providers. But it's a good faith effort to try to recognize that there are cost pressures But you have to, at least within some of the continuing care providers, look for other opportunities that facilities have to meet cost pressures. We've probably done more work in that in the nursing facility area. The pay-for-performance program that I referenced just recently is another opportunity for those that demonstrate good outcomes to receive additional resources. We have other components in the institutional side, bed closure programs that allow people to right-size their organization and become more specialized in the services that they provide. We also see in the institutional side, the nursing facility side at least, a movement towards other payer sources that contribute to a facility's ability to meet the needs of its customers, Medicare, insurance, et cetera. I wish I could be more helpful in demonstrating a complete understanding of the business pressures of the continuing care providers. They're, you know, that's about it for comments. Thank you.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, long-term care coverage facilities are also trying to deal with this increasing pressure from case mix. You mentioned earlier that more and more services are being delivered in home settings and outpatient settings, and that's leaving people with more intensive needs in long-term care coverage facilities. We've heard from some of them that that needs to be accounted for in reimbursement and the increases. How does your plan account for that change in what's happening in long-term care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, the nursing facilities are paid on an acuity-based model. So as their acuity increases, as the needs of their consumers change, the amount they are paid specific for that individual changes also. So they have quite a number of rates that apply to payment based upon an assessment of the patient as he or she enters the facility or their conditions change.
Thank you.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley. I have Commissioner Cohen. I just wanted to weigh in on also the I worked in a nursing home for 40 years, and the district that I represent down in Faribault, Minnesota, the three nursing homes in that town can barely keep their doors open, you know, let alone work harder, longer, and more. And so the 2% increase in the performance pay, it doesn't even come near the need in those homes that I represent. And I wanted to also just make a comment about, you know, the residents that we care for today in the nursing homes are patients who would be in an acute hospital setting. The disease processes that they present with in the nursing home are much more severe. So the 2%, is almost an insult to those of us working in that in those nursing homes. I just wanted to comment on that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, was that a question or a comment?
The 2%, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It is actually a question as to how could, how can we meet the needs that we already have with just 2%? And then how can we perform? And, you know, we want to perform better. Those, you know, I speak, I think, for the direct care workers. We really want to do a better job and yet it's just not there. The 2% doesn't do it for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, the 2% rate proposal is not intended as an insult, of course. We meet with the nursing facility stakeholder group and have a mutual interest to try to get to a payment system that better represents the needs of the of today's consumers. And we would continue and are continuing to meet routinely to try to find ways that we can agree to transition the system to a more current system. We've just not been successful in agreeing, so we're left with rate changes like this as our primary tool.
Commissioner, when you do these pay for performance, are there things that that you can learn or that the trade organizations can learn on how to improve across the board rather than just the individual institutions?
Mr. Chair, the quality add-on has provided a great opportunity for the nursing facilities to learn, to examine their processes, to examine their approach to delivering care to the elderly and people with disabilities living in nursing facilities. It has resulted in a tremendous amount of education, both by the department as well as by trade associations, to how to reduce turnover, how to improve quality indicators, how to be more successful in consumer satisfaction surveys and understanding what the consumers need. The pay-for-performance program, which again has not been implemented yet, we're in the process of reviewing the proposals and scoring them and then moving to the negotiation stage, will be another opportunity to learn what facilities do and whether it works or doesn't work and be able to share with other facilities around the state and hopefully replicate. So, yes, there is a tremendous amount of learning that is taking place and will take place. And facilities are investing. They are trying to truly increase their scores, increase their performance, and become far more focused on meeting the consumer's needs.
It's always amazed me that you can have two nursing homes, you know, a mile apart, paying their employees the same, and one has a 70% turnover rate and the other is 30%, and yet they have the same amount of money coming in. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the 2%. Does that include monies for capital outlay, too, for the building, air conditioners, heating, all those kinds of things? I'm not acquainted with all these budgets yet, so...
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, no, that is not intended to be used for capital needs. We have a different component on the nursing facility payment program that allows facilities to spend up to approximately $1.4 million and receive a rate increase to recognize that capital improvement. And so there are other ways for facilities to have that part of the business recognized. There's a minimum threshold that has to be met in order to receive a rate change for capital improvements also. And that is about $225,000. So they have to get to that level of expenditure and not exceed the $1.4 million. They're eligible for an immediate rate increase.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Assistant Commissioner, I agree with the comments about the inadequacy of the increase, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you mentioned the right sizing, and sometimes I think at first that was to respond to modern needs for alternatives, but I think lately a lot of it's been about dollars and that you can't make money in the nursing home business, but you might be able to make some in assisted living or some other type of services. And so after having just seen, all of us were invited to once again hear Tom Stinson go through the demographic change that we're facing, I'm wondering whether or not you and the industry and counties and advocates have been working together to really put out a plan for the future. My fear is that the nursing homes that are closing, at least some of them that I'm aware of, we're dealing with the most severe behavior problem people, or people with, you know, severe weight problems who specialize in particularly hard to serve populations that are not necessarily easy to care for, recruit staff to take care of. And I'm really worried about, as we see this demographic swing in the next 10 years, are we going to be undersized in terms of the types of facilities we need to serve this growing special population?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the right sizing, the bed closure programs, and there have been a variety of them over the last number of years, are intended to help facilities manage a shift in the marketplace. Even though we have taken thousands of beds out of the system, occupancy, by and large, has not changed because consumers are choosing to receive services elsewhere. At least in the immediate horizon, we don't have a concern about having a sufficient number of beds. Whether off into the future there will be a sufficient number of beds is a critical question. We've been working to answer that question within our program developments. The industry has been working at developing a model to try and project what's the right number of beds for the future. And we're probably all part right and part wrong, because there's no single answer as to what the right number of beds that will be needed. But even if we're closing beds today that may be needed in the future, they're the wrong kind of beds. We're closing outdated facilities. We're closing facilities that are 30, 40, 50 years of age. They're not going to be able to meet the needs 20, 30 years down the road. So the question isn't so much do we need to retain the beds that or the buildings that are currently in existence, but what do facilities need to look like 10, 15, 20 years out to meet the needs of the consumer at that point in time. But I believe that there is still excess capacity in the nursing facility program, and that the market is helping define what the right number of beds are.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to, and I'm sorry if you didn't mention this, are we just to kind of get a ballpark, the numbers I see, it looks like about $15 million for every 1% increase, $15 to $17 million. Do you have, just so we, if as we think about other numbers, we have a sense of that in mind? And if you don't have that, we can get that later.
I'd have to get that. I don't want to. I might pick the right number off the sheet here, but I might not also. So I don't want to mislead you.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. The group has kind of said that the 2% increase is an insult, and we're kind of kicking around on that. And as I join in, we're going to be put in the shoes fairly shortly that you are in of having to come up with a budget, and the critics on the committee all have to become artists. And we would like to spend more, and invite you come back to criticize us at that time. If we were to double the amount of increase to go from 2% to 4%, what area of prioritization from the administration's perspective do you see the best first place to spend that money?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, I think we have an interest in maintaining balance. I don't think that we would advocate tilting the rate increases from one sector to the other. I think all of the continuing care providers provide a service and that consumers need or want, and we've been careful to treat all providers similarly so that we don't disadvantage one set of providers versus another. Is there going to continue to be a shift to home community-based services? Certainly. But all sectors need to compete for employees. They need to compete for resources. And so, if I may, I'm going to decline trying to prioritize one provider group over another.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. And Commissioner, thank you for your continued work in reform. I think it's so important that we try to get all the parties together and reach consensus, but I know how difficult that has to be. But my question is, as you look at into the future and you consider that some of us have long-term care insurance, others, you know, will simply privately pay, to what extent does that change your projections about what will happen in funding for nursing homes, or aren't we at that stage yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it certainly is a very important component of how we're looking at the future. We've studied how people are planning for their older years, their later years, and we are concerned that people are not planning and that there will be a substantial portion of the population that will be challenged to meet their health and long-term care needs. But the products that are available are changing. Nursing facilities, the institutional model, is not used as it perhaps was used 20, 30 years ago. The statistics that are coming out of the Minnesota Department of Health indicate that the median length of stay in a nursing facility is decreasing. And I think the latest data was 35 to 40 days. So there's a substantial portion of people using a nursing facility benefit in a very short duration, and then they're returning home. We are learning that people can be supported in a home and community-based environment far more effectively than we thought 20 years ago. And that evolution will continue. So as technology continues to be developed to develop supports and smart houses and assistive devices, etc., it's not predictable yet as to how far that can go, but we know we've got a long ways to go. We're concerned, and as part of our planning efforts, we're not quite there with the boomers getting quite old enough to really be impacting the delivery system, but every year that goes by, we're getting closer.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, and I just want to echo Representative Abler's comments. I understand you are just the messenger, but I have two questions, and I think they're maybe related, and I'll try to be quick, and that is, could you give me a range of the wages that the workers in these facilities make? And I know there are different levels of providers. And also on page 166, the level of direct care staffing, does that refer to the ratio for staff, you know, nurse to patient ratio? And if so, can you tell me what that ratio is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, I don't, I guess I'm not current on the wage ranges, but we can get that for you. I'm sure the trade associations have some data that we can assemble for you. The direct care staff is a measurement that looks at a broader range of staffing. It's not a it's not a measurement of nursing staff exclusively. We have purposefully and specifically tried to incorporate other staff members who have direct interaction with residents, such as therapeutic recreation staff, social workers, and others. So it includes the clinical staff, but it's a broader ratio to the patients.
If Commissioner, if you supply us that information, could you also relate that to what national standards would be, and how I'm particularly interested in the staffing ratio.
Okay.
Where does Minnesota fit in the world? Continue.
Next we will, I think if I've kept track here, we're on page 172. There are approximately 100,000 people with disabilities who are in the medical assistance program in Minnesota. About half of those, about 46,000, receive some long-term care services, whether that be institutional services, home care, or what we'll talk about in a moment, waiver services. There are additional people, though, who do not receive services through medical assistance benefits. And so I want to make sure you get kind of the broad scope that there are people with disabilities who are receiving non-medical assistance services through state programs and counties that we also are focused upon. And I'll talk about some of those specific grants in some of these succeeding pages. But there is a lot of attention, and rightly so, to long-term care waivers and home care. They pay for a collection of medical and health-related support services that enable low-income Minnesotans who are elderly or who have disabilities to live as independently as possible in their communities. There are five waivers, and let me explain what a waiver is. In order to be eligible for medical assistance, you need to need or be at risk of needing institutional services. That's the federal definition. That's the federal agreement that we have that defines the partnership between the federal government and the state for Medicaid, and it's approximately a 50-50 match of dollars. Well, in order to not receive the institutional entitlement of Medicaid, states need to seek a waiver. They need to seek permission from the federal government to provide services in a different manner than originally designed, which was the institutional, be it nursing facility or intermediate care facility for developmentally disabled. So we have five waivers that we have over the years negotiated with the federal government. There's some history that perhaps would be helpful. The Supreme Court in 1999 decided in what's referred to as the Olmstead decision that the Americans with Disabilities Act includes supporting people in the most integrated service setting possible. And so it added additional momentum to the trend towards home and community-based services for people with disabilities and elderly. Each of the waiver programs is intended to serve a particular population, but I just want to comment that there's blurred lines that have evolved over the years. So there's not a precise, we try to be as precise as possible, but there's not a precise distinction between the different populations because people may have multiple needs that would qualify them for a waiver program. Just to go through the five distinct programs, we have the mental retardation and related conditions. MRRC is what you'll hear a lot. That is a major waiver program that allowed the state of Minnesota to move people from state-run hospitals into the community. And Minnesota was one of the early adopters of deinstitutionalization. But it moved money from the institutional side of providing services into the community. We serve roughly 14,500 individuals each month in this waiver program at a cost of about $5,000 per month per individual. It's a very large program, and it requires a fair amount of management and activity surrounding it to make it work well. The elderly waiver is an additional agreement with the federal government for those who are over the age of 65 and, again, need a nursing facility level of care. We're serving about 9,000 individuals in Minnesota through that program currently at a cost of about $1,000 per month. I'll note on the elderly waiver as a distinct difference in how it's managed. The elderly waiver is being merged into our managed care programs. So those elderly waiver is being managed by health plans, county-based purchasing organizations, etc. And that's a recent phenomenon. It's trying to recognize that in many circumstances, the coordination of medical care and long-term care supports is critical to meeting the needs of the whole person. We're in the midst of that transition. There have been some bumps along the road that are requiring us and the counties and health plans to work through, but we are working through those challenges, and we hope that the integration of those programs will result in older Minnesotans receiving a better and more timely set of services. The Community Alternative for Disabled Individuals, the CADI waiver, serves people who are disabled and, again, are in need of a nursing facility level of care. We serve slightly under 8,000 people each month in Minnesota, and the cost of that is about $1,300 per month. This has been a growing program. We've had some growth limits in the program in recent years to more effectively manage the resources that are being directed to this program. Again, there are people who in nursing facilities are able to live in the community, and if they're eligible for the waiver, they're enjoying a community-based life rather than institutional life. The traumatic brain injury recognizes the unique needs of those who have suffered a brain injury. It's very specific to that population. It's smaller than the others, but just as costly, about 1,100 people at an average cost of about $4,600 per month. And then we have the smallest of our waivers, which is the community alternative care. These are really high medical need individuals who are served in the CAC program, and it's relatively small. It's about 182 individuals monthly in the state of Minnesota. A feature of the waivers that I'd like to highlight, and we believe is the future of many of our programs, is the consumer-directed community supports. It's referenced on the bottom of page 172. We are committed to allowing consumers to more direct and decide what services they need, who's going to provide them, where they're going to provide them. It's a learning experience. It's a learning experience for us. It's a learning experience for policymakers. It's a learning experience for consumers and their families to try and make those decisions that impact their life each and every day. On the bottom of page 173, you'll see kind of a numerical count of individuals who are choosing their services through a consumer-directed option. The numbers that you see there are actually, as of June 30th, the January 1/07 numbers are slightly higher than this. So we're seeing some growth as counties are learning how to work with consumers and their families and define how to best use that particular feature. You will see on page 174...
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I'm wondering, are you getting any signals from the federal government? What I'm wondering about is if they're going to get serious about trying to reduce the deficit, they're going to have to change the way they do business or do business in a different way. I can see it go both ways, and part of the reason for my question, I can see one alternative would be flexibility, allowing states more flexibility to provide services in a lower cost manner. The other side of the coin I can see is that they would tighten it up so that they can ensure that there's no fraud and waste in the system or somewhere in between. So I'm just wondering, you know, that they can ensure that there's no fraud and waste in the system or somewhere in between. So I'm just wondering if you've seen any hints or any thoughts on which direction they might be going in regards to waivers and what the states can do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're doing both. They're pursuing a number of initiatives that are looking at tightening up the system, whether that be via Congress, via administrative rule. I think the oversight that we're all experiencing and accountability for how dollars are being spent throughout the system is alive and well, and we're all trying to learn from that and eliminate any dollars that are not spent effectively. But they have given clear signals that consumer direction, home and community-based services is the future. And the federal government has been pretty clear that that's where they'd like to see the system go. I think that Minnesota was a, particularly on the people with disabilities side, was a earlier adopter and actually recognized it probably before the federal government recognized that serving people in the community is the better way to go than the institutional side. I think the aging network, federal, state, county, et cetera, is catching up to trying to learn how to support older people. It's clearly a direction of the federal government to incent consumer controlled, consumer directed services, empowering the consumer to make choices that are more flexible and meet their individual needs. Clearly there are signs.
Representative Roth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much for that answer. One thing, I'm not as familiar with the budgets as maybe I ought to be, and I'm certainly trying to get in that direction, but one complaint I often hear, whether it's true or not, is that because we do things in a way on the state level that is more than what other people do, we often get penalized in terms of our federal matches, the federal participation. I'm wondering, do you get the sense that if Minnesota is going to be a leader in moving in that direction, is it your sense that the federal government will say, good for you, and let's do more, or, hey, good for you, you're on your own? I mean, do you get a sense either way on that, in that regard as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that sense. I guess that would be a question that would probably be more pertinent to our federal relations people who interact with federal officials on a daily basis.
Commissioner, could you give us an example of somebody that's in the consumer-directed system as opposed to what he would be getting as opposed to what he would get if he was in one of the other waivered services?
Mr. Chair, I think the consumer-directed program allows for more flexibility. There are not necessarily, and we have program people here that can speak very specifically about the programs, not necessarily a different set of benefits, but I would characterize it as how to get there is different. For example, being able to select your caregiver, being able to pay a neighbor, a friend, some specific family members, as opposed to having to go through a formal agency, provides more flexibility in how you're going to receive your services. I'm just looking at my notes. I think that's probably the dominant feature of more flexibility rather than a different set of benefits. People's needs are people's needs. And so they're able to spend the dollars that are very targeted to their particular situations. And it's not everyone having to receive the same set of services.
And I assume they're limited to the same dollar amount they would have gotten there.
Mr. Chair, there is a process, there's an assessment process and a budget methodology that the consumer works with the county to determine the appropriate number of dollars that are available for this option.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just quickly want to go back to the waivers, and I just had a question. You mentioned under CADI that there were growth limits in the program, and I'm wondering if you can tell me how many people applied but didn't get that waiver.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, the growth limits that have been in place have provided 95 slots in the caddy waiver per month. And there is an existing waiting list, as reported by the counties, of approximately, I know it's here. It'll be easy to turn. About 400 on the waiting list.
Representative Bunn.
Yes, Chair and Commissioner, on page 162 with the previous grant program, you have in your at a glance, you compare the cost per month through the home base versus the cost per month in a nursing facility. Under the five waivers on the page we're currently looking at, for three of the five, the number size per month is much higher than on page 62 what a nursing facility costs. I may be looking at apples and oranges here, so I just wanted you to comment on the, and not that there shouldn't be other things that weigh into the decisions other than the cost in terms of choosing between community and institutional, but from the state perspective of paying for these services, the costs mentioned here, for example, for the brain injury and for alternative care, which are $4,623 and $3,584 respectively, relative to that, what that would cost in a traditional institutional type setting.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the waivers are managed what we call in the aggregate. So it doesn't mean that each individual in the waiver would be more costly or less costly than an institutional service. It means in combination, everybody in the pool compared to if all of those same people would be in the pool in the nursing facility is more cost effective. So it's not appropriate to say that the average cost in one compared to the average cost in another is the right comparison because they're managed differently. The nursing facilities would demand, by the rate structure, a much higher rate if some of the costlier people in the waivers were in that program.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. The MAs for the elderly waiver. What's the income and what's the limits to qualify for? That's just the same as the MA program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen. Yes, that's correct.
And do you know what that number is off the top of your head?
Medicaid eligibility.
The income. Amount.
Income and assets.
And assets. Well, I can get it later. That's fine.
Thank you. Continue, Mr. Commissioner.
We'll continue on page 176, where we have a proposal on elderly waiver assisted living. We'll talk a little bit about assisted living. The governor is recommending that we require individual care plans to support the use of elderly waiver in assisted living settings and provide consumers who are considering moving to assisted living settings with information about in-home options. It's well known, and we've touched upon earlier, that assisted living is a very fast-growing product. We don't know all that we need to know, though, about how consumer decisions are being made about the choice of this product. And so part of this component is to propose a study to take a look at how are consumers evaluating their needs and making the choice to move into an assisted living setting. Additionally, we want to enhance the support for those consumers who are making these choices. We'd like to create a website that would complement the consumer, the uniform consumer information that is being developed with the stakeholder group. It's being developed by the Minnesota Department of Health and stakeholders and ourselves to inform consumers about what is assisted living, what do you expect, what are the costs, all of those kinds of elements. We would like to offer long-term care consultation to those individuals who are entering assisted living that is similar to what we do in nursing facilities. Currently, it's required that an individual who enters a nursing facility receive a long-term care consultation. The intent of that many years ago was to inform that particular consumer about what options are available in the community, either prior to entering the facility or perhaps to move out of the facility if their conditions and needs improve. We would like to do the same thing with those that are entering assisted living to make sure that they are, in fact, making a informed choice. We would like to link the websites that I just referenced to tools, a consumer decision-making tool that is already available through MinnesotaHealth.info, a spend-down calculator so that they can actually see if this selection, how long will their resources last them. So there's a very strong component of consumer education and interaction to make sure that this growth product is being used most effectively. The next element that we would like to have considered within this proposal is to modify the way we treat 24-hour supervision in assisted living under the Elderly Waiver Program. Currently, it's an all-or-nothing approach. If you need 1 hour of supervision, it means you fall into needing 24 hours of supervision. And the rates that are paid to providers have to correspondingly be calculated. What we're proposing is to move towards a more tiered approach that would comprise some level of variation. Could be 4 hours, could be 8 hours, could be 24 hours. Work with stakeholders to define that. We're not defining that here, but to work towards the a more of a spectrum of supervision assessment and then be able to target resources more appropriately to those decisions. Those are the elements we are requesting under this proposal. One full-time equivalent to conduct a study, to work with the results and the other components of this proposal so that we can be better informed about how assisted living is being utilized in Minnesota. I will make one quick note.
Mr. Chair, or Mr. Commissioner, one quick note is all you get.
There are about double the number of housing with services units in Minnesota than there are nursing facility beds. That's been the explosive growth. So last count, and I could stand correction if I'm behind the time, there was about 80,000 registered housing with services units in Minnesota compared to we're now down about 37 nursing facility beds. So I'm just trying to give a proportion there.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And this, what you were talking about was a change page?
That's correct.
So with that, it's time to adjourn today's meeting.